All right. Good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for taking your time joining one of the final sessions at TechEd with us here today about choosing the right deployment tools. My name is Johan. This is Michael. We will be your hosts for the next 75 minutes. But we love questions, so keep them coming through Twitter by raising your hand and ask the questions. Either way. And rather than me and Michael talking about what we do, where we work, what we like, we have created a video instead. So if Mr. Audio Guy can please keep the volume on this PC, we should be able to kick this off. Can I ask you to play? Back to PowerPoint, please.
Thank you, thank you,
thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Next slide, please.
I can do slides.
Advanced PowerPointing.
Yep.
Next.
Yeah. I took training.
As you can hear from the accent, we live in Sweden.
Right.
We used to work for the same company. We don't anymore. But as in the irony of everything, we do more work together now than we used to when we worked at the same company. But that's life. This used to be a request from the TechEd folks who creates all the sessions to have an interactive discussion around deployment. So we said, sure, we can do that. And they then come back a few weeks later and say, right, can you do a breakout instead? All right, fine, we'll do it. So that's why we are here. We are going to cover the main components that Microsoft makes available to do OS deployment. We don't mean that each of these components is a complete solution, but together as foundation pieces, they actually build components. And for you as IT pros to be able to have at least a little chance whatsoever to be able to do in-depth troubleshooting, well, guess what? You'll need to learn the tools as well. So in this session, we are going to focus on both the tools that actually build the solutions and, of course, demonstrate the solutions as well. Next.
Next slide.
Next slide. So we have Windows setup. Windows 7 setup is exactly the same as Vista and absolutely not the same as XP. So we have everything image-based now. Even if you run setup exe, it's still deploying an image, even though we can use other tools to apply that image as well. But the setup itself, no matter how you deploy it, is using a simple answer file to do automation. So we have an under 10 XML file. That's where we can provide the answers. And that's what I'm going to show you quite shortly here.
I have a question for you.
Already?
Yeah, already.
Okay, we love questions.
So you told me that from Vista, it's going to be an under 10 XML file. And in XP, it's a total other story, right?
Yes.
What about Windows 8? Is that going to be pretty much like XP, or is that going to still be an under 10 XML file?
So here's the deal. We are not covering Windows 2008 R2 server in this session, but accidentally, everything we do and say applies to it. because server has the exact same setup mechanisms.
Yes.
The unattended XML file that we use to automate the setup, we author through the Image Manager tool or Notepad, but it's better to use the Image Manager tool. It's simply about having setup find it. And the easiest way to have setup find it, put them on the same media as you have the setup, and it will find it, as long as you name the file correctly. You can also put it in specific folders. For example, if you apply an image, you can put it in a folder, and setup will also find it, assuming you named it right. So, next. It's boring. Let's do demos. It says demos.
Says demos.
Can I have my machine?
Yes.
All right. So, this is my Hyper-V host. I'm running server 2012, but I'm going to deploy Windows 7 to it. I'm going to start a client, and I'm going to mount the normal ISO in it, the normal DVD that you have been seeing for the last 3 years or so. This is a Service Pack 1 ISO, a 32-bit, and I will simply boot on it. And shortly, it will load WinPE. And shortly after that, we will see the old-fashioned setup screen going on. This, by the way, the yellow and green and stuff that is flying around, you may not always see. Sometimes you will see the green Vista bar instead. That is if your hardware can do 1024 by 768. So if you have a netbook and deploying Windows 7, you don't get those things, you get the Vista one. But all the time when setup sort of starts its environment, even before I launch setup, I can press Shift F10 and I can get a command prompt for troubleshooting of the setup. So if I go into the Windows folder, I can see I have a log file called setup-act.log, which will show me some information about the setup so far. So no matter what deployment solution you are using, could be MDT, could be Config Manager, could be ImageX, could be Windows Deployment Services, they all at some point in that scenario will kick off setup. And if setup fails, those solutions will not help you. You will have to dive into the setup log file and try to figure out what happens. So in this case, you see we have not so much information yet. But this we can automate. So to create an unattended XML file, I simply go back to my server. I open up Image Manager. And I wait patiently. It's coming. This is a Microsoft moment. I can select, I can open an answer file. And here I have an answer file. And as you can see in Windows 7, we have these 7 distinct sections in it. In the XP days, we used to have different answer files. Now we have one, but depending on what we do, we have windows or different sections in the file. But this is where I can go in and customize. I can add components. I can, for example, go in and add, I want to configure my drive. So I will go to the setup. I will add a disk configuration. I will right-click, and here you can see you can actually not do wrong in here. The image manager will prevent you from applying the wrong settings to the wrong face. I mean, it would be quite bad if the setup would allow you to do disk partitioning of the OS drive in the end of the setup. It makes more sense to do it in the beginning of the setup. And so forth. So you simply configure components in here. And then you save the file.
I have a request for you. That's really good. One of the things that many users don't really like is the Internet Explorer welcome thingy every time they log on to a new computer.
Oh, I love that feature.
Yeah.
No, I don't. No.
You're the only one on the planet.
No. Well, features, settings like that can, of course, be, or I would say should be in most cases, applied through group policies. Quite easy, but what if you do work group deployments? Group policies tend to be slightly more challenging.
Yep.
Then, of course, we can go in and set configurations like that in here. So if you really don't like that first run wizard, well, you can go in and set it, obviously. So this also controls settings of this setup, not just all the answers. Now, the trick here is to actually save this file with a unique name, and it needs to be named auto unattend. And what I've done here on my host is I have created a floppy, a virtual floppy, where I have put an unattend XML file named auto unattend. So I simply save the one that I have on my server, I saved it on a floppy, could also be a USB stick, could be on the same media, could be on another hard drive. I save it in the root and I name it auto unattend here. So naming is critical. And then I take the same virtual machine and also add in the floppy that I created with that unattend file in it. And I simply reset it, and we should now see a different behavior than we saw recently. So it will still boot into WinPE, but instead of asking me a bunch of questions, it will read the answer file and do those changes accordingly.
And if you want to see a floppy, there's a museum in Redmond where they have floppies in different forms and shapes. It's a thin plastic thing that used to be used a couple of years ago, like 50 or something. I don't know.
When you were young.
Yes. Yeah. And that is like 100 years ago.
All right. You can see setup is kicking in. I did not click anything, but this is because it found the auto unattend XML file and is now continuing the setup. Okay. You can see setup is running. But what we also can do is that we can create custom boot images. I mean, now I was using the boot image that is on the DVD that you download. But you can also use the WIC kit to create your own custom boot images. So for that, you will open the deployment tools command prompt that comes with Windows Ike when you install it. And by the way, it's Windows Ike for Windows 7 that you should download from the Microsoft site. They had a sort of a fun versioning thing of that binary, because the same binary on the same site has been called version 1, version 2, and currently version 3, but it's the same binary, but it's Windows Ike for Windows 7. Now, I can run the command copy PE, I can specify the architecture, and I can specify an output folder where I want my WinPE, so it will be Mike01 here. And it will create a boot image or a WinPE in that folder. If I want to do any changes to it, I can mount it. So I have here an empty folder called mount. And I can use imagex mount read-write that WIM file, index number 1, and open it in the mount folder. So shortly we should see that what was previously empty is now stuff in it. And I can press F7 to get a command history, and I can see that, all right, I have stuff in that file now. If I want to copy items to this folder, I can simply copy in Explorer, or I can even load offline registry items in WinPE if I want to do changes in the WinPE registry. So I'm going to load a temporary hive here, and I will point it to mount, Windows, System32, config, and the default hive. So I'm loading that into memory. And in my demo folder, I have a registry file here somewhere, WinPE, where you go. And this registry file simply changes the command prompt in my boot image, the settings. So I will simply import that registry file. So I will do regedit/s. I could have also double-clicked it, but this is more fun. And here we go. So I'm importing that reg file, and then after I've done my changes, I can do a reg unload, specify the same hive again, and the changes are now being stored back into my boot image. Now I need to commit those changes, and before I do that, I need to actually close all Explorer windows, because Windows Ike has a tendency of not liking when there are open file handles to stuff that I have opened. We will actually see the cleanup process fail, but after you have done that like 10 times, you start to remember to close the Explorer windows. So imagex, unmount, commit, and the mount folder. And now the changes I did will now be committed and saved into that WIM file. Now I can create a bootable ISO image of this. So I can move that file into the ISO folder, sources, and I gave it the name boot.wim. And yes, these sessions are recorded. So if you don't have time to type everything that I type, no worries. You can download them after 24 hours and you can see what I've been doing here. So I'm moving the file into that folder. I'm using the osdim command. I need a bootloader. I have one in this folder. Long file name support and the ISO folder and mic01.iso. See, I'm nice.
Thank you.
Naming it after you. That's nice. So now I can take this boot image, copy it to my host. Mic, here we go, mic. I will copy the mic ISO. And I will take the same VM again. That's not the same VM. And I will revert it to do clean snapshot. I love Hyper-V. And you can insert that ISO. Mic. And I will boot from this ISO here. So again, it will load WinP, but it will look a little bit differently than it used to when I booted on my Windows 7 default WinP image. It's gray. I got the green customized background because I changed the offline registry key in WinP. It's starting WP init, meaning starting network. And if you need to troubleshoot that point, yeah, guess what? There is a log file in this folder, wp-init log. This is where you can find information about, all right, which driver did Windows try to load and how much time did it spend doing it? And in this case, I can see it's loaded that device driver for that device. But if you do an IP config in WinP and it returns nothing, that's a good file to look into because then you can realize that, all right, I'm missing a NIC driver. But in this case, what I can do, I can easily format the drive, if I can type correctly. I can run disk part. I can create a primary partition after I've cleaned and select the disk. It helps selecting disk first.
Yep.
Disk 1, no, disk 0, actually. And then I will create a partition. I can format it. NTFS file system, I will make it real quick.
This is the fun part. Switches from nothing to 100%.
Yes. I make it active and I will assign a drive letter to it. So now I have a volume, which is my C drive, it's 100 gig or so in size, 126. Now I can map against the network share and simply use ImageX to apply that image. So don't tell anyone about my password, please. Mapping up. Go into the demo folder. Where did I put the ImageX? Over here. I can use ImageX. I can say apply. I can simply specify a folder here where I have a operating system image, sources, install WIM, index number 1, and then the C drive. And then when I hit enter here, it will now start applying that image to the drive. And the answer file that I had before, what I can simply do, I will not start this process because it takes a few minutes, but if you put a file in the Windows System 32 sysprep folder, the setup will find it. But then you only need a shorter file because at that point we already skipped the first part of the unattend file, just the last three sections in it. We're starting with a specialized phase and continue down. So one way of deploying Windows is to create a custom boot image, map against the server, apply the image, and at the same time, make sure to copy a well-formatted unattend file into the sysprep folder, and then you also have a fully automated setup. But creating ISOs and doing these manual processes, well, it's fun and it's good for learning, but how efficient is it for a deployment solution? I would say not very. But it's still critical to know that this is taking place in the background, because when we need to troubleshoot stuff, this is something you will have to do manually to try to figure out why things break. So do we have any existing, for example, Config Manager customer in here? A few of you? How can ImageX be of use if you're running Config Manager as your OSD deployment solution? Because, I mean, Config Manager sure is not using ImageX. It's not. But how can ImageX be of use? It's a good comment from the back. It's using ImageX to create a reference image and then import it, yes. But how can we use it to troubleshoot stuff that we have in Config Manager? Well, a good example is you start a deployment, it fails, you suspect the image is corrupt. Well, you can simply use ImageX, apply the image to a folder, a superior test to test if the WIM file is okay in 5 minutes, rather than doing a 45-minute deployment just to realize, all right, it was corrupt. I need to create a new reference image. So knowing these tools can also help you quickly navigate stuff that help troubleshoot stuff that you normally don't have. So PowerPoints, please.
PowerPoint's coming up.
Yes. Next, please. Yes. So instead of booting from running around with CDs or USB sticks in the environment, which is, you know, probably good for you know, body workout or something, but it's much easier to have it booting the deployment over network. And here is the thing, you need to be friends with the networking group to make that happen, because they doesn't always allow you to do pixie boot. So, shorthand story, if you can't make friends with them, you are forced to be running around with a CD or a USB stick. But if you can make friends with the networking group, well, then we can go to any given machine, hit F12, start and download the boot image over the network instead of booting from a media, and then the setup process will continue that way. And I'm pretty sure you are ready.
Demo. Oh, my God. It's my turn.
Yes, sir.
I'm almost ready. So Windows Deployment Services is a services that do two things. It does help me with Pixie, and it does help us with multicast. That is the two things that we use in a deployment solution. However, Windows Deployment Services can do other things too. You can use Windows Deployment Services as a very simple solutions for special locations that happens every
fourth year?
Something like that.
Olympics?
Yeah, pretty much. The Olympics is the only scenario where we actually find Windows Deployment Services to be a working solution. Your goal is to install 400 computers. They are exactly the same. They will be installed once, and they will be destroyed 1 week later. No support, no maintenance, no nothing. In that case, Windows Deployment Services will most likely do a really good job.
I really think it's a little bit longer than 1 week, actually.
Yeah, they do it in a month, I think. So this is Windows Deployment Services. It's a service that we add. It works from Windows Server 2003 and up to the current version, Windows Server 2008 R2, and it will still be there in Windows Server 2012, as far as I know. Adding the services is pretty easy. You go to Service Manager, and then you find the roles, and then you add a role. And if I go into roles, I can barely hear. Should I be more quiet, or
no,
should
speak
I speak
less?
Speak up. Okay, sorry. So you do add roles, and when you do add roles, you're going to realize that we have Windows Deployment Services installed. The Windows Deployment Services role has two components. It is the the transport and deployment server. And the transport server is responsible for actually transporting data. The deployment server is what we need to have to have a GUI. Without the deployment server, we don't have a GUI. It does work without the deployment server. You just need to configure everything using regedit, if you prefer that method, which is fine if you know what you're doing. In the Windows deployment services, then you need to configure it, otherwise it won't work. And there are a couple of things you need to take care of. Number one is the pixie response. The default settings is do not respond to any client computers. It's very good. The do not respond to any client computers means you installed something and it doesn't do anything at all. Most likely you would like to shift that. Then we have two options, respond only to known client computers, which means that they need to be pre-staged in Active Directory to be recognized by this server. The other one is to respond to everything, either it's pre-staged or it's not, it's going to answer anyway. And then we have the little option to that, which says require administrator approval for unknown computers. That means if the machine is not recognized by Active Directory, it's not pre-staged, it's going to wait until someone approves that machine. The last thing, the require administrator approval, is something we only use when we have a bare Windows deployment services configuration. Otherwise, we don't. We can specify if the machine is going to be joined with a certain name, if it's going to be in a certain organizational unit. And I know that my friend Johan, we had some opinions about this, because in many of the classes and trainings, everybody seems to install the Windows deployment server on a domain controller, which you should never ever do, but they do. If you do that, it's going to work perfectly fine, because you're going to run the service with the domain admin privileges. And that privileges allow the service to add a computer in any organizational unit. But in the real world, you put it on a member server, and the member server doesn't really have permissions to create machine accounts in every organizational unit. So at the training, everything seems to work. Then you go back home and nothing seems to work. Anybody been in that situation before? Works in a lab, doesn't work in reality? Yeah, so you need to run the service with permissions, an account that has permission to actually create the account if you're using this method.
Then there is also another reason not to running on a domain controller, because often if you have a domain controller, you also have DNS on that machine for security reasons. And DNS and Windows Deployment Services, they by default, they don't really like each other.
No, I think the team doesn't like. I mean, the team behind this, I think they're trying to fight.
I don't know about that, but they are like claiming the same ports.
Yeah.
And there are two ways to fix that. So if you go to the networking tab.
I can do the cheating one. Here's the cheating one. Don't do this. You increase the
port range.
Port range.
So now they are less likely to actually collide.
Just increase it more.
Not very good. But you can also change the behavior. In R2, in 2008 R2, Microsoft added in a registry value. It's called UDP port policy. And if you set that value, you can actually tell the service, rather than just claim ports, go ahead and ask for ports. So that is if you really...
System?
No, it's a servicer. So that will be system. Current control set services. WDS server, whatever.
It should be...
Or control F could be.
Here it is. Is it parameters?
Could be. UDP port policy. And you change it from zero, sorry, from 1 to 0. This is how you enable that selection. But the obvious workaround, of course, do not run DNS and Windows Deployment Services on the same machine.
That is correct. You can also configure things like client unattended installation. And there's two, this is the fun part. There's actually two unattended files. There's one unattended installation for the partitioning and formatting of the machine. And then you have another unattended XML file that is connected to the actual install WIM file, which means that the disk configuration settings are connected to this server, not the image, which means that if you don't pre-stage machines, you're just going to use the simple configuration, you're going to need one network per unique disk configuration. Since WDS is a pixie server, can't have multiple pixie servers on the same network, you're going to need one network for each each disk configuration. Nobody's put it up that way, so the only way to make this work is to have pre-staged devices. In that case, it works. So we configured that. We can also configure, of course, multicast. And there's a couple of settings in the multicast. Either you obtain the IP address from the DHCP server, but more important is these settings, the transfer settings. If you do multicast and we have a client and that client is connected with the bad network cable, that client will slow down the deployment of every other machine. So rather than waiting for the guy that actually drags everything behind, we can say, well, you know, just divide them. Just separate clients into three sessions.
It's like lane on a highway, you know, trucks to the right and sports cars to the left. Yeah.
And this works very simple. You deploy 10 machines, one of them is a bit slower than the other, and that will automatically be put in a second stream. All the machines that is put in the medium speed zone stream, if there's one machine in that mid-size that is also slow, that's going to be transferred over to, I'm so sorry, but you're really, really slow, so you're going to end up over here instead. It's also using something called autocast, which means that we don't need to fire up every multicast stream manually. The multicast stream is also always ready to be delivered, which means that if a client hooks up, it immediately starts to stream. When the next client hooks up, he's going to jack into the same location that the other guy is, so obviously he will miss some of the bits. So when everything is done, the WDS server is going to ask the clients, did everybody get what they were supposed to get? And one of the clients or a couple of clients will say, no, sorry, we missed block 0 to 4049. Do you mind resending them? Which means that the autocast retransmit the missing blocks again until no clients have any more vicious for getting more.
So multicast not only reduces the load on the network, it can actually help you if you have networks that are sort of a little bit unreliable. We did a job together with an airline, and they had 18 gig images, which is a quite large image. And if we deployed 100 machines in their training environments, 5 of them would fail. And we knew it was a network problem, but we couldn't find it that quickly. So we just enabled multicast, and simply the problem went away because of the ability to resend the failed packages. But as with Pixie, multicast do requires you to be friends with the networking group, because without their support, without the configuration, multicast can actually make things worse in the environment rather than helping it.
The reason is very simple. Multicast is actually something that doesn't exist for real in the Ethernet protocol. Instead, multicast is actually broadcast. And you don't want to have a broadcast storm in the network. We have had some issues with this. Customers has enabled this. They tried to deploy it. And the wireless network just died. I mean, it died, right? Nobody can work. Nobody can access anything on the wireless network. Why? Well, the access port on the wireless network doesn't really support IGMP. So they pick up the stream and say, oh my God, this is a broadcast. So they start broadcasting the WIM files over the wireless LAN, and you can figure out the rest. So it took a redesign in the wireless network to make that work.
Unplug it?
Yeah, pretty much. It was VLAN and routers and stuff, and like, then we couldn't make it work. So, yeah, you can have some issues with it.
So how do you get this to actually deploy an image?
It's pretty easy. We need two images. Number one is we need a boot image. And
that's the boot image I created before.
Yeah, pipe. Could be, but since there is a boot image, we could use this one, or we could use the one that you created, as long as
but
it...
That one doesn't have a green text.
No, it doesn't have. On the other hand, that image has the function for logging in to the Windows Deployment Services. So you need to pick either the boot image or the install image. Which one do you think is the boot image?
I would guess the smaller one in size.
Yeah. The name doesn't give you a clue here, size is giving him a clue. That's correct. So you take the boot vim, you import the boot vim, and then you're done, right? It takes a couple of seconds. Then you need to add the operating system image, and to be able to do that, we need to create an image group, and then we add the install image, and the install image is called?
Not boot.
Not boot, exactly. It's the large image, since the name doesn't give him a clue. It's going to be the large image in this case.
Yeah, okay. I think it helps if you select it.
Yeah, I already selected it.
Okay.
Yeah. Didn't you see that? No. Really fast. Okay. So if I pick up this one, you see I can create the multicast transmission. If I do that, I give it a name.
Mike?
No. Johan. And here's the autocast and settings. There is a possibility to do scheduled casts. I have no clue on why you should do that. I always do autocast.
I think it's for people that were used to running Ghost, for them to still feel...
Yeah, I think so, too.
...comfortable.
It has to do something with it. It must be something like that. Anyway, you can create it that way. It's nothing fancy about that. If we go back to the image again, if we have the nice unattended XML file that Johan actually created for us, we can then say allow image to install in unattended mode, and then we just pick that unattended XML file, so that unattended XML file will be connected to this image. For the formatting and partitioning part, we need to go back to the Windows Deployment Services. We need to do properties again.
Client?
Could be client. Enable unattended installation, and then you browse, and then you pick up the unattended file for formatting and partition.
So this is all in great and fun. We are deploying into a virtual machine.
Yes.
Of course, it will work. But in live production environments, we often struggle with hardware.
Drivers.
Real hardware.
Yes.
Drivers. So how do we add drivers
into
the picture?
Oh, they fixed that. You can see you have something called a drivers node here. So now we can create drivers packages. I'm not going to do that, but I'm just going to show you a driver group. And I'm going to do properties on this driver group. And it says driver packaging matching client hardware. That's plug and play. That's really nice. But plug and play has a small issue. It's depending on the vendor that creates the INF file. So plug and play really works. It's just that everybody is not really that good on writing INF files for some reason. I don't know why. Which means that in some cases we can have the wrong driver installed. So we need to have some filters to make sure it doesn't happen. Let's see if we have any filters. And we do have that. Manufacturing equals to HP. Which means that if it's an HP machine, that's going to be filtered out. Or it's a Hewlett Packard or a Dell machine or a Lenovo or something like that. But in some cases, the manufacturer is not good enough.
It's for service, actually, HP.
Yeah, this is for service.
And they're using Hewlett Packard for clients. We don't know why, but they do.
So if manufacturer doesn't is good enough, then we can select other things like filtering on the vendor of the BIOS.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Yeah, or the BIOS version, or the UUID number, which is going to be strange to do. So the best we found so far is to do it by chassis type. Because now you can specify that this driver is supposed to be installed based on the chassis.
We don't mean this.
It's a joke. Because nobody in this room can't, because I can't, explain the difference between other and unknown. I have no clue.
We simply think that the people who wrote this wizard or designed this filter, they were just really hungry. Because I think we can have an entire...
Yes, we can start with the...
Lunchbox?
No. Let's start
sub for breakfast?
Let's start with the sub. Sub is a breakfast, then we have the lunchbox, and then we have the pizza box, and then later on, we have the all-in-one. It's very simple. It has to be someone with an interest in food. No, so we can't really use this. It works when you have a very few vendors and a very few models, then it really works. But the problem is that over time you get more models, more vendors, it's changed, and you still need to keep your solution without rebuilding it over the time. It's just very boring. So it kind of works.
Windows deployment service does have driver injection, but it's extremely, extremely limited, and it's extremely relying on plug and play. And you would be surprised to learn how much hardware that doesn't want to be found through plug and play. For example, if I deploy this HP, it's an IS8540, it has a smart card reader in it. If I don't plug in a smart card during my deployment, it will not detect drivers needed for that. So they will not be installed. So when the user finally injects that smart card, can't find a driver, and the user is not allowed to install drivers.
There is an opposite around. Anybody heard about the Synoptics touchpad driver? That gets installed on anything. You have a Hyper-V host, and you're deploying a Hyper-V machine, and sure enough, that driver is going to be installed. The application blows up, and it says, you know, it seems to be something wrong with your hardware. It's virtualized. It doesn't have a hardware. So, because they use the same plug-and-play number as generic mouse, which means that it's going to be installed everywhere. So, yeah, kind of works.
But we still love Windows deployment services. We really do. We just don't like it for deployment. We like the foundation it provides us. As Michael said, Windows Deployment Services is really good on one thing, and that is applying a very static image to a machine. But if you want to dynamically inject drivers, updates, applications, settings, Windows Deployment Services is not for you to be used as a deployment solution. Next slide, please. What we recommend is rather downloading the MDT toolkit, and I'm just curious how many in here are playing around with that or using it. About half of the room, good. Because these friends together, Windows Deployment Services giving us Pixie and Multicast together with MDT, they will give us a really, really good deployment solution that does allow for very flexible driver injection, Windows updates, applications, and settings, all fully automated as part of your deployment. So we basically remove all the limitations that Windows Deployment Services have, but we still use it because we need the foundation pieces to get the image being transferred down to the client. So, Monsieur?
Yes, so Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. That is Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. It's installed. I haven't done anything except installing it, and I also have created a deployment share.
Before you continue, it does require Windows 8 and it's Windows Ike, and it does require PowerShell because it's relying on those components and .NET Framework 3.5.1.
Which is a new requirement for the MDT 2012. That is correct. So creating a deployment share is not that hard. It's a folder that eventually has a share with a name, ask some questions, and you're done. So, I think I can do this in my sleep. Can you? Done it before?
Yeah.
You've done it before. When that is done,
it's still a management console, so yeah.
Yeah, I know, it's MMC. It's, we need to make MMC happy from time to time by rebooting MMC. I think MMC is good, but it has improvement potentials.
No, it isn't actually. It's not good.
It's not good. Just check. I'm trying to be polite here, okay? So I created a deployment share. There are so many ways to do this, right? Okay. What we would like to show you is that if you don't spend a massive amount of time, it can still be used straight out of the box with very little customization. Because when we come to customers, it's like, no, I've seen the MDT demos, I know what it is, but it was really advanced and I don't have time to build all these fancy solutions. I'm just going to deploy 1,000 machines. I think it's better to just run around with a CD or a DVD. It's like, are you just... And I can't say that when I'm a consultant, but there are things sometimes you really want to say to people. So we would like you to understand that without doing any super fancy deep diving coding, it's actually working out of the box.
Just within 15 minutes, you can actually have a deployment solution that works, it's automated, supports apps and drivers and stuff. So
here's very simple. You put applications under applications. You put operating systems under operating systems. I think you got the drill. And still, sometimes you get questions. Where do I put the applications? I don't know. Try applications. Oh, that's a good thing. Yeah, it is. So operating system, we need an operating system. We need to import an operating system. There's two ways. I know you can see three. Do not use the Windows Deployment Services images thing. It's much easier to import them as full set of source file or custom image file. The Windows Deployment Services images is more of a...
Avoid the third one, but in MDT 2010, we always recommend using the top one. So if you can do the magic Sumit. Sumit is the utility for people in the cheap seats up back there to see. But in MDT 2010, that was the best way to get deployment done correctly in MDT. For 2012, we don't do that. For 2012, we select the second option, custom image, and we do that for everything because that works with everything. Now we can have a single 32-bit boot image deploying everything that we have instead of having to have multiple boot images.
And we are using something that is called a failover method because MDT 2012 searches for the setup.exe. If it can't find it, it's going to use ImageX to apply the image instead.
And if we never add it, it will never find it.
So it's going to fail over and use ImageX apply instead, which is faster.
And this is also cool because that also works with all kinds of WinP versions and also with all kinds of Windows versions, even upcoming Windows 8 versions. Setup fails on that part.
So if I go into my raw folder, which I have somewhere around here, and I search for my operating system, and I go into sources, I got an install.wim file. Move the files instead of copying it. And on this, it says, don't you really need a setup and sysprep files? No, I don't really need those files. I used to need them in the old version, but we don't need them now. Install, no, it's going to be called Win7x64sp1. Next, next. Finish. Wasn't that hard, right? Okay, what do we need then? We need some applications, right?
Yep.
Okay, we're going to need Office. New application. Applications can be basically two things. One is that it's a real application that is installed, blah, 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 blah. But in some cases, we use applications as packaged command line things. To be able to put in the task sequence, it could be just a command. Applications with no source files, application name is do stuff. And yeah, the command is, I don't know, /online. Because you want to add the games. Or it could be net.exe, something, add a user. It could be, I want to connect to an iSCSI network. Well, in that case, it's iSCSI CLI.exe. And it's just running a command. So it doesn't really need to have it be an application for real. Office, in this case, is a real application. So I'm going to select an application with source files. And it's not going to be called that. It's going to be called install Office 2010. Next, source directory. Let's see, do I have a source directory here? Maybe I have, yeah, it seems to have the Office 2010 here. Move the files, next, next. The command is setup.
already set up .exe. The problem is that the working directory is incorrect. I'm going to need to this is a bug, actually. We need to do it again. New application bundles, going to install. Office 2010. Next, source. Row, where is it? There you are. Give me my office. Move, next, next. Set up .exe. And Office is a special application. It's special in the way that it's going to show me something called Office Products. So it's going to be a tab for Office Products, which means that I can do this with other Office 2010 products too, like Visio, like Project. And if I want to add language files to those, because you need to have the both German, Swedish, English, then you use the add and you just import those particular language files and they will be correctly added. Don't add multiple products into one Office suite. Have Visio, Office, and Project as separate applications because it's easier to manage and not everybody's going to have all the applications anyway.
And if you don't see the Office Product tab, it's probably because you added a non-volume license version of Office. You really need to have the volume license version.
There is one other scenario when you don't have the Office tab, and that is when you add the Office 365 product, because you need to download the admin folder, otherwise it doesn't show up. So there is this Office, you download it, install it, but there's a special download for being able to do what's called Office customization. So the admin tool is not there. Question?
So the question was, does this method create a custom MST? Yes, it does. Will you automatically have one created? No, Michael is actually creating one right now, and we will save it in the updates folder.
But if you do have one, you have one and you want to use that, just drop it in the update folder, and that will be used. The only thing that is important is the naming of the file. This is not really documented, but you do all the configurations you want to do. There are a bunch of them that you might want to change. This is the normal setting for Johan, for instance. I don't really like the first wizard, and I don't want to send the customer improvement program, and I might want to do that. So there are a bunch of settings you might want to do. When you're done, you save it, and you save it in the updates folder. And this is the updates folder that I have in the OS deployment folder, applications, office, updates, and I save it in this folder. Now, the most important thing is to save it so that it will show up as the first file in the list. The easiest and best way to give it is 0 something, because that will most likely be the first file. There is a small chance that you otherwise have problems because you're going to add other files. As you can see, I have other files in this folder. This is the Service Pack 1 files because this is how you patch Office. You download the service packs, you extract them, you put them in the updates folder. When you install Office, Office realizes that, hey, here's patches and plugins and the Outlook Facebook connector and the LinkedIn connector and the whatever connector you want to have. Just extract them, drop them in the folder. They will be installed during the installation, which is pretty convenient. And then you just save the file and you're done. And you close this and Office is done.
All right, so that was an app. What about drivers?
We need to have drivers. There are two ways of managing drivers. The number one way, well, maybe we should do this too. Should we do this? So we can say always suppress reboot. And if you do Office 365, it needs to be display level basic.
Well, you could have done that in MST as well, MSP.
That is correct. I could have done that in the MSP file too. So we need drivers. And there's two ways of dealing with drivers. Either you just import the drivers and you hope for the best. You have three models, you're running HP, you're going to only install Windows 7 x64. There's no point of actually managing drivers. If you feel that there is a slight chance that over the years you will
have
maybe
more than
have
three.
Yeah, other models, other operating systems, other vendors, then you should switch over to a more controlled way. And we prefer this method. We figure out the following. In this machine, the product name, which is the model name, is HP EliteBook 8540W. And I can use that as a parameter or a variable inside Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. So I'm actually going to steal that.
When you start a deployment with MDT, it actually learns quite much of your machine, and model is one of those things it learns. And everything MDT learns, we can use as filters and other stuff in our deployments.
This is good if you only have one operating system. What about having multiple operating systems? Well, in that case, maybe we're going to create Windows 7 x64, to be really sure. Yeah. And then I put the folder in here and delete that folder. These folders are only logical, so it doesn't exist in reality, which means that we now have a folder hierarchy which says Windows 7 x64 together with HP EliteBook 8540. Now I need drivers, so I'm going to import drivers. And here are some drivers. And to be honest, in this case it's 8560. We also download all the drivers using the right tools. There was a session yesterday on that. So check that session out. But we use the correct tools to download the drivers, unpack them, go into the folder.
If yesterday was Monday.
Yeah, sorry, it was...
it was on Monday.
Monday.
I know that because I did that session.
Yeah, I know. I think I know. I was there, right? I think I was there. All these sessions just go together. You're going to see some yellow things from time to time. Yellow things is when you smile and say, that vendor doesn't know how to write an INF file. Because they have incorrectly defined that drivers to be a 32 or a 64-bit driver, but Microsoft Deployment Toolkit will actually open the correct driver file and realize that, no, that driver is not a 64-bit driver. We are going to turn it off for 64-bit. Try to just install other vendors, and you're going to see there's a difference between quality on vendors. Try some of the software vendors.
So we create folders named after the model. We import the drivers. And to match this all together, we need to have a sequence, and we need to change it.
Correct. So we're going to create a sequence called Windows 7 x64. And it's going to be called Windows 7 x64. Next. Next. I'm going to pick an operating system.
Yep.
Next. And I don't need to specify a product key. We're using a volume license. We're going to have a KMS server. If we do Mac, we can type in the Mac key here, but I'm not going to do that. Name, organization, website. We need a password, right?
No.
We don't need a password. He say we don't need a password.
You can specify passwords in the server settings later, so you don't need it.
Okay, so I'm done with apps, OS, drivers, sequence, done, okay, properties. The problem is that the default setting for a task sequence is to, question over there.
So the question is related to Config Manager and not Light Touch. Is it 07 or 012? 2007. There are two hot fixes related to importing duplicate drivers in Config Manager 2007. So if you do your Bing on hotfix and drivers for 07, you will actually find a hotfix that does allow you to import duplicate drivers. There is an unsupported hack if you really want to import a duplicate driver, and that's to create a unique text file in the driver folder, because then config manager will think it's different, because when it tries to figure out if it's unique, it's actually doing a hash of the entire folder where the driver is in, and in that way you can force it in to the system. But these two hotfixes are required if you want to deal with, for example, you want to assign categories, which you normally do during an import, and that will take that problem away. In 2012, you will have the option of selecting that during import. You now have a drop-down. We have four items or four options how to deal with multiple drivers. And the default action is allow import a driver, store it only once, though, but add the new category. So you get the same behavior as that hotfix I mentioned.
So the drivers in LightTouch is going to be installed during the phase that is called pre-install. And most of you can guess that we have something called inject drivers. So let's go to inject drivers. Inject drivers has the following setting. All drivers install only matching drivers from the selection profile, which means do a plug-and-play scan and copy all the drivers down to the machine and let Windows pick from that driver store when it powers on.
Default method is called total chaos.
Correct. It's just another word. So we're going to switch this into nothing, which means that it's not going to have any drivers at all. And then we're going to say, well, don't do the plug and play copy at all. Instead, copy every driver from the selection profile of nothing down to the hard drive. And everybody that can do some kind of calculations realize that nothing is going to be nothing. That is, however, incorrect, because it is possible to add
folders to be added.
Yeah, by setting a task sequence variable called driver group 001. And in driver group 001, I can then specify something like Windows 7 x64 / % model %. And the last part will, of course, by LightTouch be resolved into my HP EliteBook 8540W. And this corresponds to the out-of-box drivers folder hierarchy that I actually just created, which means that the only thing I now need to do is that for each and every model, create the folder for each and every model and put the drivers for that model into that folder, and the only drivers that will be downloaded to that machine will be corresponding to that model. That is called total control.
It's so a little bit more work up front, because you need to create the folders, you need to import the drivers, but in the long run it gives you really reliable driver repository, because the default method, the total chaos method, it's as soon as you change a single driver, if you just have all the drivers in a giant list, if you change one wireless driver, you need to retest every single model that you have. If you have them in a unique folders, I've changed the NIC driver for this 8560, well, I only have to retest the 8560 with the new NIC driver, and I know I don't have to retest all my other models. Yes, sir? Sorry?
So the question is, where does it place the drivers on the target operating system? Yeah, so it's what it's going to happen is that it's going to take this variable and find all the drivers that matches that, and it's going to copy everything down to C:\drivers. And then it's going to, in the unattended file, which they already did, it says, if you need a driver, it's going to be in C:\drivers, and search that folder. And then it's going to delete that folder after the installation has been done.
So it's a three-step process. The sequence is copying down the stuff. That script will inject them into the driver store, and then the machine will reboot, and Windows Setup will actually install the driver. So that's what... Nothing you have to change, absolutely not. This is taken care of. As long as you get the folder name right to what model's name you have, MDT will find the driver and inject it happily. Yeah.
One of the reasons we prefer to do this is what's called multi-tier drivers, multi-bus drivers,
two-tier drivers.
Two-tier drivers. USB 3. Very nice. It's going to find the USB bus, but it doesn't copy the driver because the USB driver 3.0 is behind that bus. Network adapters, graphic adapters, audio adapters, everything is half deployed because the plug-and-play scanning only finds the first tier, not the tier behind. Because the only way to find that is to load the driver, and that we really don't do. So this is easier to do.
You need to move on, sir?
Yes, so I'm pretty much done here. Of course, I can add things like Windows Update and enable that, but basically this is done. If I need to tweak the unattended XML file that Johan showed you before, it's the edit unattended XML file, and I go in and I modify, like, don't show the Internet Explorer wizard, things like that. I'm done with that, right? Next step is to configure my Windows PE. And when you deploy operating system using LightTouch, the scratch space is set to 32 megs, and that is a small problem when you have a large driver. If you do have like an NVIDIA driver or something like that, it doesn't really fit into that 32 meg scratch space because that's going to be the temp folder when it extracts and copies the drive. So we need to modify that and make it bigger. So 128. And when we have set it to 128, fine. We are good to go. So we can modify that. And when we're done with that, basically what we do is that we do an update deployment share, and that will create a boot file and a WIM file and an ISO of image. And either you can use the ISO or you can use the boot file. I'm not going to do that because I've already done it, and it takes a couple of minutes to do it. So let's switch over to a machine. This machine is, in this case, booting on a WDS server. And what I've done is that I copied that WIM file that I have here, and I just copy that WIM file into this by saying add boot image, and then I browse to my deployment share, OS deployment, and in boot, I'm going to find myself a very nice 32-bit WIM file.
So this is how we do the integration. We update the deployment share in MDT, we get the boot image. Then we take that boot image and add as a boot image in Windows Deployment Services. So it will be available when we Pixaboot shortly. It's coming.
It's coming. And then it's going to fire up the LightTouch deployment wizard, and it's going to tell me that you need to log on, you need to authenticate. And everything you see in the LightTouch wizard can be skipped, modified, automated. It's just about modifying text file. But we encourage people to just start using it to make it work, to get a process running. And then, by the basis of annoyance, you're going to find out how you get rid of different questions. I have answered the following questions 600 times. I'm getting annoyed. How do I get rid of it? But it's more important to just get something to work before we even start doing the automation stuff.
So it's you guys that decide how much you want to be questioned when you ask start a deployment. Some customers, they ask for many things. Some customers, they ask for sequence and computer name and applications. Other customers, they automate everything. It's you that decide that level of automation. And if I ever see you again logging on as administrator, I will.
Yeah, I know.
It's going to take a while.
I have a headache here.
Yeah.
And then you pick the operating system. Okay, that's not hard. Give it a name. Johan, search you. Workgroup would be fine in this case. I'm not going to restore data from another computer. This is a fresh install. I think that's good, right?
English, yeah, good.
Yeah.
Select Office.
Yeah, I would like to have Office. I like Office.
No,
I'm just going to deploy the machine. Nah. Okay. And and you're done. Which means that if your goal is to be able to install 10 machines, it's faster to just install Microsoft Deployment Toolkit and do none whatsoever customization. Just import the things straight up. Oh, but I'm still going to need to install a couple of applications manually. Fine, so be it.
So this, Michael, is obviously a network-based solution. What if you just really want an offline media that will do exactly the same? You have 3.5 minutes to create a working deployment solution on a media.
I can do that. Media path. And I need to create a folder. Make folder. Media. Scissor 2.
Next.
I'm almost done. Oh, really? Next. Finish. Right-click. Properties. To make it really fast, I'm going to remove the 64-bit. I'm going to change this to 128. Okay.
Right-click.
Update.
Done. This is how you create an offline version of the network deployment solution. And the end result is a giant ISO that you can burn to a DVD, or you can copy the content to a USB stick. So you can drive the entire deployment from that USB stick, but you will still be prompted with the exact same wizard, again, that you can automate. So in the last 2 minutes here, can you show me, while this is running, how to, for example, disable the language thing?
The language thing. You don't want to see the language stuff?
No, I don't want to see the language.
Okay.
I was thinking more Notepad, but okay.
Yeah, but I can do Notepad too. You want to see Notepad stuff?
Yes.
Notepad is fine. So let's open up.
Because the configuration that you saw on the properties of the deployment share is just the .ini file in the file system. So you can just as well open it up in Notepad.
Yeah.
It actually feels more hardcore to do that. It does.
Okay. So here's the text file.
And if you change the font so
yes,
people can...
I'm working on it.
I'm a bit annoying, right?
No. Not a bit. So here is the text file. It says settings, and settings going to read the priorities. And priorities then matches to different blocks. So in this case, I'm going to say reading all these blocks. In this case, it's going to read in a block and base that on MAC addresses. So here's the setting for a MAC address, for instance. But if you go down to the default settings, you're going to see here that we have a bunch of skips. I would say skip locale selection. Would most likely skip locale selections. If I want to set a password in the machine, there's the password.
That's the admin password.
Yeah. And here's how you set it. So those settings together with that setting would automatically set it to Swedish keyboard with Swedish locales, Swedish language, whatever, and then don't ask for it. So it's everything about text files. And the file is called custom-settings.ini. So this is pretty easy.
PowerPoints, please.
PowerPoints coming up.
Every session at TechEd is being recorded and has been a bunch of sessions related to MDT throughout the week. So if you haven't seen them, I encourage you to go in and download them and view them, because MDT is a really powerful deployment solution. We actually built it from scratch to finish in, I would say, 30 minutes or so here. And rather than doing manual stuff, we encourage you to start using the solutions as they are, because they are really, really powerful. And with that, we would like to thank you for taking the time. Remember to fill in the evals, please, and have a great week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.